Hello and welcome to National League Town, Mets fandom, Mets history, Mets life, with Long Island's own Greg Prince and Jeff Heisen. Hey, Greg.
Hey, Jeff.
On today's show, Greg takes us back to 2003, but first, a behind-the-scenes look at National League Town. After we record yet another five-star episode, Greg and I kick back with some Johnny Walker Blue, and we keep talking. Some people have said, why aren't you making this available to your Patreons? And I answer, well, we don't have any Patreons. And a recent discussion involved Aaron Rodgers. This was when Aaron Rodgers had his introductory press conference. And Greg said to me, Aaron Rodgers is a bad guy, and I'm a Jets fan. Greg's a Giants fan, but we don't have any animosity toward each other's teams. This isn't a Mets and Yankees situation. I said, yes, I know that, but he's now my quarterback, and they didn't ask my opinion, and I have to root for him and hope he does well. It's the same thing with Rick Pitino. I root for the Johnnies. I went to St. John's for law school, and Chris Mullen was there, and it was impossible not to get caught up with the St. John's men's basketball team, and I've continued to root for them, even though they haven't been as good. And I know Rick Pitino's a bad guy, and I don't want him as the St. John's coach, but there he is. So I have to root for him to be successful and return St. John's to their glory days. They didn't ask my opinion. So on today's show, we talk about what it's like to have personal values and root for players that don't share those values. As Jerry Seinfeld said, we root for laundry.
I don't believe we root for laundry. I've grown to really dislike that line because it was hilarious when Jerry Seinfeld said it the first time. And every Mets fan has repeated it through time. I don't feel I root for the laundry. I feel I root for what it represents in my life. But the people who wear the laundry, sometimes I wish weren't wearing the laundry, much as you have described. I went through an element of that in the last few years when my favorite basketball team, a team I rooted for almost as long as I rooted for the Mets, the Brooklyn Nets, going back to the ABA, when they made as a centerpiece of their organization, Kyrie Irving. I don't know if Kyrie Irving is a bad guy, but Kyrie Irving conducted himself in a way that made me not at all want to root for him. I was left during the post-pandemic period of both wanting him back on the court because he was the one guy who wouldn't get vaccinated and was therefore holding the team down. And I wanted him not on the team at all. And he would continue to give me reason to want him to go away. And then he went away and the team wasn't as good. I was fine with that. Sometimes you just feel that way. You mentioned the Giants. I remember when the Giants got Plaxico Burress. I had nothing against Plaxico Burress, except I remember seeing a news report when he showed up for his big free agent meeting with the Giants, he was wearing a Yankees cap. I don't want to see that. I know that's not the same as not sharing our values, but it's even worse somehow. We make those deals all the time. We read quotes all the time. Guys that we've been rooting for all along, you suddenly realize, oh, that guy isn't for what I'm for. The Mets went out before this season, signed a guy named Brooks Raley. Very decent guy on the surface. Has given me no reason to root against him, no reason to regret rooting for him, except I know that in Tampa Bay, he was part of a, we'll call it a cabal of players that had a problem with the Rays honoring Pride Night. It's like, what the hell is that all about? And maybe if I could sit down with Brooks Raley, we would have an exchange, we would understand each other better. But really, all I want him to do is get outs. And when occasionally a ball falls in, maybe I'm not as sad as when a ball falls in against Adam Ottavino or David Robertson. And maybe Brooks Raley wouldn't want that much to do with me based on whatever it is I'm thinking of. You know, sometimes you read articles. I remember way back, spring training 1988. And again, you know, this is the Mets of that era, that beautiful era when we were just a little more than a year removed from defending a world championship. And we would be on our way to win a division title and compete for another world championship, hopefully. And Marty Noble in Newsday did a story asking in this election year, hey, who are you voting for? Almost all the players were voting for somebody I would not have voted for. You know what? I don't really want to know this. Now, maybe this is a version of shut up and dribble. And maybe that does not speak well for us as fans. You know, we want to know players. We want to feel like we know players. We want to feel we understand what they're about. We want them to feel unfettered. But then maybe one of them says something, oh God, I didn't know he believed that. That's horrible. When you see a retired ball player on Facebook sometimes, or Twitter, or whatever Twitter is called today, and you see what they are spouting, you kind of rewind in your mind to thinking, wow, I rooted for that guy 30 years ago, 40 years ago. You know, that's not really the same as what you were describing with Aaron Rodgers or what I was going through with Kyrie Irving. It's like, ugh, am I really going to sit there on, say, Sunday afternoon rooting for the Jets, as I do, not as my primary team, but I like them and I wish them well. Yay, let's feel good about Aaron Rodgers, the guy who's just said so many weird things. And probably yes. And I think you will too. You might regret it in a way. You might have a little voice inside your head. You know, you want everybody to be on the same page as you, or at least to not know, I think, what page they're on sometimes. And I'll leave my thoughts on this subject in a sports area. I think we've probably both watched the season premiere of Winning Time, the second season. I know we both watched the first season. And one of the portrayals in that most entertaining show is of Pat Riley. In the first episode, which picks up where last season leaves off after the first year of Magic Johnson, Jerry Buss. So it's 1980, but they flash forward a bit to 1984. And spoiler alert, folks, Pat Riley becomes the coach of the Los Angeles Lakers at some point. I don't think I'm giving anything away. And it just made me remember, it was kind of stunning seeing it in Winning Time, where he's gone from being this sort of background character in 1980 to the man in 1984. Which is what he becomes, and that's what we know him as. And that's what I knew him as circa 1991 when he came to coach the Knicks, who I still rooted for somewhat at that time. And I had nothing really against Pat Riley. It was just this idea that, oh my God, the Knicks have been so blah for so long. We have to go out and we have to import glamour. We have to import competence and professionalism. And it was just such a downer. And I just remember like thinking, what is Pat Riley doing here? How is he coach of the Knicks? And sometimes you just feel like, what? Why do I have to root for these superstars or super personalities? What is Rick Pitino doing on St. John's? Sometimes that stuff is just a downer. Sometimes you can turn it around. And in some years, you just learn to put up with it.
And I don't think we have a choice because, again, they're not asking our opinion. I went through this with Tim Tebow on two of my teams. I couldn't stand Tim Tebow, and let's not go into the reasons. And then he was a Jet, and then he was a Met, and I rooted for him. I wanted him to succeed. They're not asking our opinion. Sam Coonrod will be a Met by the end of the season. He did the same thing that Brooks Braley did when Coonrod was on Philadelphia last year. Are we being hypocritical? Because some people say, shut up and dribble, when people on the left offer a perspective. We cheered Mark Canha and Taiwan Walker when they supported Pride Night. And now we don't want to hear about Brooks Raley's opinion. So are we being hypocritical or just being human?
We're being human. And, you know, we do have an opportunity to say, you know what, I'll not root for so-and-so when he comes into pitch, when he comes up to bat. You know, I mean, we'll make those little bargains in our heads. We will not, you know, put his picture up over our bed, so to speak. We're adults. We are entitled to say, I don't really want Brooks Raley to be a Met for the next 5 years or whatever. Or we can just say, I want the guy who's pitching to do well. You know, I want to stress Brooks Raley has done nothing wrong as a Met.
No.
Not on the field. He's had like maybe two bad outings. Conducted himself perfectly fine. I don't know what goes on in the clubhouse. It shouldn't really be any of my business. The other night, it was a game I was at. I didn't realize that both Francisco Lindor and Pete Alonso were posing with Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner and their families. I have no idea what that implies other than probably somebody pulled them aside, the players, and said, hey, would you mind posing with them? And again, for all I know, Lindor and Alonso were like, oh my God, you're great Americans, which is an opinion I don't think either of us shares. Or it might be like, yeah, sure, like one more set of photographs with fans. Or somewhat VIPs. Maybe they were like, hey, I recognize you. And then 2 seconds later, they were back to getting ready for the game. Because I've seen how that works and, you know, just people coming and going. And the next day, you see pictures of Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner and Mets, who you profess to love. And it's kind of how did that happen? But you don't really want to think about it that much. So, I don't think any of us becomes a fan of the team we become a fan of, especially when we're kids, thinking about any of this stuff. Sometimes things trickle in. I mean, one of the guys who has been in the middle of this in a couple of different ways in recent years, not lately, Daniel Murphy. I mean, we love Daniel Murphy, but Daniel Murphy said some things when Billy Beane, not the Oakland A's general manager, but the diversity and inclusiveness guy for MLB, no E at the end of Beane, had come in to talk about what MLB was trying to do. And Daniel Murphy said something like, "Oh, I would have love in my heart for all of my teammates, whether they're gay or not, but I don't approve of that lifestyle." And like, well, who left it to you to call it a lifestyle? This is what these people are, or a individual person is. And Murphy took some flack and perhaps did some growing, according to Billy Beane. And again, that's the way you or I would put it. Somebody else might say they brainwashed Daniel Murphy. At the same time, I remember Daniel Murphy got into a controversy because he took a 3 days of parental leave when his child was born, and there was an idiotic talk radio controversy that Daniel Murphy shouldn't be doing this. His job's done once the kid is born. He should be out there playing second base. And instead, he was invited to the White House when Obama was president, as an example of, caring fatherhood or whatever. And I remember, somebody in my Twitter feed saying, Obama man, Daniel Murphy. And I'm thinking, I don't know that that's true either. We like Daniel Murphy because of the way he played baseball and the way he talked about baseball. And maybe it's just best to leave it at that and understand that these people are in our lives because of baseball and that they're entitled to their opinions. Just as, dear listener, you're entitled to your opinions. I have no idea what you, and I don't know who I'm talking to exactly, what you're thinking about when you're not thinking about the Mets and how you think, and that's probably just fine. You may have been listening to this for the last 10 minutes and thinking, oh God, Greg and Jeff are awful. I hope not. I hope we still have common ground, but there are times where you don't necessarily feel like you want to conceal that you want to shut up and talk baseball. I've noticed over the years, sometimes I'll delve into the social media bios or go down rabbit holes with people who've commented on things I've written, and I see, wow, this person is very much in sync with what I think. Wow, this person is 180 degrees opposite to what I think. But we're all here as Mets fans, and we're all happy about Jacob deGrom after he pitched a great game or something like that. So sometimes I think you just kind of have to understand that people are people. And again, we have the option. If you really don't want to deal with Aaron Rodgers, don't deal with Aaron Rodgers. Just say, I'm glad the Jets won today, and I wish Zach Wilson was starting or whatever. And now I realize if Aaron Rodgers takes the Jets to the Super Bowl, unless he does something incredibly averse to your value system in the 2 week period between the conference championship and the Super Bowl, you're not going to care. You're just going to be like, oh my God, he really was our savior. I guess as people, it's harder to deal with in this day and age, given how it feels there's so many stakes out there. Stakes, not the stakes we enjoy with our Johnny Walker Blue, apparently, that I'm still waiting to come to my table. We just have to kind of make those little bargains with ourselves if it really bothers you. As it really bothered me with Kyrie Irving, I just kind of looked away when he wasn't scoring 60 against Orlando. When he was scoring 60 against Orlando, I thought, well, he's quite a basketball player, and I'm glad he's on my team, and I can't wait for him to go away. And sometimes, again, it's just like that.
And you do have to bargain. I think that's the only way to rationalize it. When Brooks Raley comes out, you're thinking, I hope he does well for my team. When Rick Pitino takes the court at Madison Square Garden ahead of his St. John's Red Storm, I'll be rooting for him, even though I know his track record. And when Aaron Rodgers leads the Jets onto the field against Buffalo on opening night, he has my full support. I found him to be charming on Hard Knocks. I decided that I found him charming. It's a bargain I had to make. And we've had to make this bargain throughout Mets history, haven't we, Greg?
We've been sometimes charmed, sometimes disarmed, and sometimes totally disgusted.
We return to our series, It Happens in Threes.
That's right. It's the third week of the month inside this year ending in three. which gives us an excuse to present the fifth installment of a series we call It Happens in Threes. Every month around this time, we commemorate a Met year that is arithmetically celebrating a round-numbered anniversary in 2023. Our year in the three-sided spotlight this week is 2003. Happy 20th anniversary to the 2003 Mets and the 2003 season. Let me rephrase that. Happy 20th anniversary to the 2003 Mets season being over. Of all the Mets seasons I've lived through, not counting the one in which the Mets traded Tom Seaver, I enjoyed no season less than 2003. I believe it was a year engineered to be disliked. Look at the team the Mets put together. They brought in uber-brave Tom Glavine, the least likable of our arch-rivals' big three starting pitchers, and who among Mets fans much like Greg Maddux or John Smoltz either. Now Glavine, thanks to Jeff Wilpon's free agent romancing, was a Met. They brought in Yankee reliever Mike Stanton, who took time out in September of 2001 to take a not-so-veiled shot at the Mets for putting themselves in the middle of September 11th relief efforts. He implied their actions were a PR ploy. Now Stanton, another free agent, was a Met. They brought in former Marlin Cliff Floyd, who was a darn good player who had conducted a public feud with Bobby Valentine over a misunderstanding regarding selection to the 2001 National League All-Star team. Free agent Floyd also signed with the Mets, but let everybody know that if Valentine were still managing the Mets, he wouldn't have wanted any part of coming to Shea. Bobby Valentine had led the Mets since late in the 1996 season. He lifted them from futility into contention in 1997 to the playoffs twice and the World Series once. That PR ploy Stanton sniffed at was Valentine at his finest as well. Bobby V made sure he and his team were there for the New Yorkers affected most in the darkest hour, 2001. He did all he could to make Mets fans proud clear through the 2002 season, which admittedly was not a very good one. In that badly cast campaign, featuring Roberto Alomar plummeting from his Hall of Fame peak, Mo Vaughn not in the best shape of his life, and returnees Jeremy Burnett and Roger Cedeno reminding us how difficult it is to go home again, the Mets spiraled from disappointment to disastrous, finishing last for the first time since 1993. Fred Wilpon, who had just bought out his partner, Nelson Doubleday, opted for a change. Fire the manager, but keep the general manager. Bobby V's reaction, when told, was astonishment. Not so much that he'd be axed, but that his front office nemesis, GM Steve Phillips, who put together those ill-fated 2002 Mets, was going to get to stick around and get another chance. He wasn't the only one in shock. Taking Valentine's place, and thus assuring Flushing would be attractive to the likes of Glavine and Stanton and Floyd, was the recent manager of the Oakland Athletics, Art Howe. Howe, long before we knew him anew via Philip Seymour Hoffman's cinematic interpretation in Moneyball, had brought the A's to the postseason 3 years in a row and was still under contract out west, yet management didn't mind letting him go. Billy Beane didn't even demand compensation. If that provided an inkling that maybe the A's were winning in spite of rather than because of Howe, it didn't register with Fred Wilpon. In one of those comments that would be repeated every time Howe's name came up in a Metsian context for the rest of time, the owner, after meeting the managerial candidate, said Art lit up a room. He had found his man. He might have wanted to check with Con Edison regarding wattage, because if you experienced Art Howe as Mets manager, there was little incandescent about him. But he was the new man in charge. No more Bobby Valentine, who'd so defined the brilliant era of Mets baseball that was no more. No more Edgardo Alfonso either, one of the best players the Mets ever developed through their own farm system. Fonzie, too, defined the Mets, who pushed Glavine's Braves to the brink in the 1999 NLCS and stared down Stanton's Yankees in the 2000 Subway Series. A top hitter, a savvy fielder, a smart player all around, and the ultimate team man above all that. Fonzie started at third for 2 years and defended the hot corner like few Mets before him. The Mets went out and signed Gold Glove third baseman Robin Ventura. No problem, LaFon said, as he shifted to second for 2 years, keystoning the best infield ever. Hey, Fonzie was told again 2 years later, we traded for Alomar. You mind moving back to third? Edgardo grabbed his glove without complaint and trotted to the left side of the diamond. Alomar imploded, but Phillips picked up his option for 2003. The heck with Fonzie. They let him walk to San Francisco as a free agent. They also decided having the best defensive shortstop in the game wasn't a priority and offed Ray Ordonez. Feeble at the bat, he was still a magician in the field. Nah, don't need that. Ray Ordonez was replaced by drab, gruff journeyman Ray Sanchez, as if one shortstop with the same first name was interchangeable with the other. Can you tell how excited this Mets fan was to watch the 2003 Mets? This Mets fan skipped attending opening day for the first time in 6 years. This Mets fan missed nothing. On a freezing March 31st, Tom Glavine, superseding incumbent ace and Met in his sole outlier, took the ball and teed it up for the visiting Cubs. 8 hits, 4 walks, 5 runs. Doesn't make it out of the fourth inning. What a terrible beginning to Tom Glavine's Met career. If you like bookends, you are urged to look up the ending to Tom Glavine's Met career. The 15-2 loss at Shea set the tone for 2003. The Mets fell below 500 to stay by the ninth game of the season. Mo Vaughn hit 3 home runs in April, then never played another game after May 2nd, with the injuries that had sidelined him at Anaheim and made him available to the Mets getting the best of him for good. Mike Piazza, the other slugger projected to hold down the heart of the Met order, broke out of an early slump and was batting .333 by the middle of May. Then he went down to a gruesome groin injury and would miss 3 months. Right before he writhed in pain, Mike was rubbed the wrong way by his manager, who suggested to the media that it might be time for Piazza, a 34-year-old catcher with a lot of mileage on him, to start playing some first base. Thing is, Art Howe never told the proud superstar and longtime face of the franchise of those plans in advance. With Piazza out, some of the power vacuum would be filled by veteran Tony Clark, who stroked 16 homers and showed his feel for reading the room by giving up his chosen number of 00 when he realized it truly belonged to Mr. Met. Clark took 52 in Ward as well as any Met bopper until Yoenis Cespedes came along in 2015, by which time Tony was executive director of the Major League Players Association, a job that also requires a strong read of a room. Met catching, meanwhile, would fall to some combination of Vance Wilson and Jason Phillips, or Wilson Phillips, which was appropriate in that Mets fans were being told to hold on for one more year. Actually, Phillips, who wound up taking over first base for Vaughn on the days he wasn't behind the plate, was something of a revelation, hitting nearly .300, driving in almost 60 runs, and modeling a pair of goggles that would have come in handy to see exactly where these makeshift Mets were going. With few exceptions, notably 15-game winner Leiter and 16-game winner Steve Traxel on the pitching side, those who remained from 2002 weren't excelling, and the new acquisitions weren't making much of a difference. Ray Sanchez's contribution to Met lore was being spotted taking a haircut from amateur barber Armando Benitez in the clubhouse while a game was in progress. Another advertisement for the professionalism of the 2003 Mets. One glint of light managed to shine through come June, and it had nothing to do with the manager who lit up a room. One night before his 20th birthday, the Mets called up their top prospect, shortstop Jose Reyes, to take over for an injured Sanchez. Perhaps Armando spilled some Barbicide, that murky blue liquid barber shoes, on Ray or his glove. In a sense, Reyes was rushed. The Mets never had in mind to bring up a 19-year-old, something the organization hasn't done since. It was supposed to be a fairly brief trial. Fill in and go back to Norfolk for more seasoning. But once you got a glance of Jose Reyes, assuming you could catch sight of him as he tended to be a blur on the base paths, you couldn't see sending him back to the minors. Reyes, even once he turned 20, might not have been fully ready for the majors, but neither were the 2003 Nets. Jose stuck around and did a few things before incurring his own injuries. Reyes collected 2 hits in his debut at Texas. On that same road trip, he swatted his first homer, a grand slam in support of one of the two one-hitters Traxel threw in 03. But the scouting report said Jose was all about speed, and sure enough, he stole 13 bases while legging out enough base hits to elevate his average over .300. Jose would do enough to garner token Rookie of the Year support, making him one of two Mets to get voters' attention. The other was the man I like to call Sluggo, as in the comic strip Nancy and Sluggo doppelganger Ty Wigginton, who inherited third base once Alfonso left and Steve Phillips' first choice for the job, Norihiro Nakamura, thought better of joining this particular sinking ship and opted to remain in Japan as an Osaka Kanetsu Buffalo. Nakamura would eventually sign with the Dodgers and make nobody forget Ron Say. So sometimes the best signings are the ones you don't make. Wigginton may have been doing his darndest at third, but those who followed Mets minor leaguers closely knew a brighter third base prospect with luminescence on the level of Reyes was likely to usurp Ty's claim to the position soon. But that glint of light, named David Wright, would be asked to shine through in another dark year. In a season described through understatement as imperfect, one of the signature games, the good kind, occurred in Miami on June 17th. Between them, starter Jay Soh and relievers David Weathers and Armando the Barber Benitez shut out the Marlins, who sent exactly 27 batters to the plate. Did that mean the Mets had thrown a combined perfect game? I think you would have heard about it had that been the case. No, it was a one-hitter, with the one hit allowed by rookie Soh to Juan Encarnacion in the fifth, a race when catcher Phillips cut down the ambitious base runner trying to steal. So no, it was an imperfect game, but it was quite impressive. It was the only time the Mets have ever limited the opposition to the minimum number of plate appearances, and it came 2 days after that Traxel one-hitter in Anaheim and one night after Florida sensational youngster Dontrell Willis one-hit the Mets. Three one-hitters in three consecutive games, with the Mets winning two of them, and one night after that, once the Mets completed their series victory at Pro Player Stadium by thumping the Fish 10-5, the fourth-place Mets led the fifth-place Marlins by a half game. If you're curious about how momentum might have worked in the Mets' favor from there, I'd advise against looking up who wound up winning the 2003 World Series. Sometimes the highlight of a season is the trading deadline, a lesson we might have been reminded of lately. In 2003, a Mets fan had that much to look forward to, especially when it was preceded by the move the Mets didn't make the autumn before. It turned out the promotion of Jose Reyes would be the last thing, certainly the last good thing, Steve Phillips would be asked to do as general manager. He was let go in June and replaced by deputy Jim Duquette. While Phillips prepared for a new career playing a sage baseball man on television for the next couple of decades, Duquette got to cleaning up the mess Phillips and the 2003 Mets had made. Alomar, out. Bernitz, out. Sanchez, out. Lefty reliever Graham Lloyd, out. And closer, when he wasn't giving haircuts or leaving the biggest games a little too open, Armando Benitez, out. Benitez piled up more saves, 160 over less than five seasons, the most by any Met righty, that are generally remembered. Because what tends to get remembered are the blown saves in the biggest spots, and Benitez piled up a few of those too. Armando's final blown save came in his final appearance as a Met right before the All-Star break. Ironically, Armando was headed to the All-Star game as the Mets' only representative. Congratulations, Duquette might as well have told him, don't bother coming back to Shea. More irony, perhaps, is that Benitez's last Met game came on the day the franchise honored the 30th anniversary of the 1973 Mets pennant by inviting back some of the players who made us believe. None was more important or legendary to that remarkable surge to the NL East title and National League flag than Armando's predecessor as primary reliever, Tug McGraw. During spring training in 2003, it was announced McGraw had contracted a brain tumor. This was the first time Tug was back at Shea since then, fitting in that the Mets were playing his other team, the Phillies. He went through a lot to be here today, Jerry Kuzman said. I've never seen him in a bad mood. Driven onto the field by another of his successors, John Franco, in the old Met bullpen buggy, Tug delivered the ceremonial first pitch that served as his goodbye to New York. Tug would pass away the following January. May not have mattered much in the scheme of things, but despite Benitez blowing the save that Sunday, the Mets came back in the bottom of the ninth to prevail with Jason Phillips driving in the winning run. The scoreboard read, "You gotta believe." You can always believe in Tug McGraw. If you were looking for feel-good stories, or at least those tinged with a little warmth in a chilly Mets year, you had to glance in the rearview mirror. On April 4th, a predictably Arctic Friday evening off Flushing Bay, who should be towing the Shea rubber for the home team versus the Montreal Expos but David Cone? Encouraged to interrupt his one-year retirement by old pals Leiter and Franco, Coney, whose 1987 to 1992 stint in orange and blue included a 20-win season, two All-Star appearances, and a National League strikeout title, reported to St. Lucie and made the team. In his first Met start since being traded to Toronto for Jeff Kent and Ryan Thompson more than a decade earlier, David threw five shutout innings, highlighted by a swinging strikeout of Vladimir Guerrero with the bases loaded in the third. Cone would make only four starts and pitch once in relief before returning to retirement by June, but at least he got to call it a career in the right New York uniform. Another pitcher associated with better Met time swung by Shea in early May. Jesse Orosco was pitching in his 24th Major League season for his eighth Major League team, the San Diego Padres. But the image of Orosco that would stay with baseball fans forever was that of Jesse striking out Marty Barrett, tossing his glove in the air, and dropping to his knees in celebration after saving the final game of the 1986 World Series. Less was on the line for Jesse on the night of May 9th, and it had been ages since he had been relied on to close games on a regular basis. Yet here in New York, with Trevor Hoffman on the shelf, Padres manager Bruce Bochy brought in Orosco with Met runners on first and third in the bottom of the ninth, San Diego clinging to a one-run lead. Switch hitter Robbie Alomar was up to face the Padres' nominal left-handed specialist. At least one Mets fan took in the tableau and decided this was a save situation, not so much for the visiting team at Shea, but for the last of the 1986 Mets. And he didn't particularly care if the 2003 Mets had to be collateral damage. Orozco struck out Alomar, and that Mets fan clapped without hesitation for what turned out to be, even though the lefty would wear two more major league uniforms before the season was over, Jesse's final big league save. It had to come at Shea Stadium, even if it couldn't come for the Mets. Of more recent vintage was another well-liked former Met who gave his old fans something to cheer in 2003. But Tsuyoshi Shinjo, like David Cohn, had the good grace to do it in Met garb. Shinjo had lit up Shea during a mostly dismal 2001, featuring orange hair, orange wristbands, and a slashing style of play. After trading him to San Francisco for the infamously large target-averse Sean Estes, the Mets brought Shinjo back as a free agent. He wasn't nearly the sensation he'd been two seasons earlier, but let the record show that Tsuyoshi had one more shining moment in him. At the House of Horrors Turner Field, and with none other than Armando Benitez, clinging to a one-run lead in the bottom of the ninth, the Braves put runners on first and second. The one on second was Chipper Jones. And the ageless Julio Franco singled to center. Chipper figured he'd score easily enough, tie the game, and break Met hearts per usual. But that was Shinjo in center, and Shinjo unleashed a throw with aim Estes could only dream of, and nailed the evil Jones at the plate to end the game. Benitez was credited with the save. Nonsense! Give it to Shinjo! As with Conan Orozco, 2003 would be the final season of the big leagues for Shinjo, though he'd keep playing in Japan for the Nippon Ham Fighters through 2006. A couple of other ex-Mets on whose behalf Shea Denison's stockpile applause also returned, albeit as opponents, and they too had more baseball left in them than perhaps Steve Phillips had reckoned when he let them go. In June, during the first ever visit to the ballpark by the Seattle Mariners, we had the opportunity to rise and applaud for M's first baseman, John Olerud. Ole did pretty much everything as the Mets' starting first baseman for 3 years, between 1997 and 1999, including setting the franchise's single-season batting average record of .354 in 1998. Now he was going to try to do the Mets in. On June 6, John came to bat with a tying run on base in the ninth inning. The Mets up by one, and who else but Armando Benitez on the mound. Olerud worked the count to 3-2 as he did so often, as Benitez did so often too. The Mets fan who clapped for old favorite Orozco striking out Alomar a month earlier tried to maintain his composure this time around. Olerud coming through against Benitez would probably be okay. Benitez, however, struck out Olerud. The Mets fan decided that was just as well. Sometimes you have to live in the present. In August, however, there wasn't much conflict of interest when the San Francisco Giants came to town. The Giants coming around in the early 2000s implied Barry Bonds would be the center of attention. And of course, Bonds drew focus and boos when he came up in the first inning on August 12th as the cleanup hitter. A runner was on second, there were two out, and Art Howe ordered rookie starter Aaron Heilman to intentionally pass Bonds. Lost in the shuffle a bit was what came next. The first Shea Stadium at bat as a visitor for Edgardo Alfonso. The Mets thought so little of Alfonso, they didn't really try to re-sign him. The Giants thought so much of Alfonso, they slotted him into their lineup as protection for the most dangerous hitter of the modern era. When Edgardo was walked unintentionally, that same Mets fan from their Orozco and Olerud scenarios didn't mind one bit. The fan was just as happy when Heilman got out of the inning, and despite Bonds eventually homering off both the Mets starter and the Mets closer, the Mets won 5-4. The closer by this point of the season was David Weathers and not Armando Benitez, but closing hadn't come easy via any reliever on this team since Orozco dropped to his knees, had it. The next night, the return Mets fans who hadn't altogether thrown in the towel in 2003 were waiting on finally happened. Mike Piazza, back from those 3 months on the DL. How did Mike announce his presence? With authority, naturally, nuking a two-run homer in his second at bat and driving in five altogether in a Mets romp. Piazza brought such a surge of juice to Shea that the next day, New York experienced a power outage so far-ranging, the great blackout of 2003, that they had to cancel the finale of the Mets-Giants series. It would be the last scheduled Mets game to go completely unplayed until the pandemic wiped away a majority of the 2020 season. Fred Wilpon's notion that Art Howe lit up a room must have been inaccurate, for Shea was as dark as anywhere else in the city. The Mets played their final month plus as if the lights never came back on. After a brief blip of hope in August, Traxel threw that second one-hitter, and Floyd, before going in for Achilles surgery, went on a tear that made us forget we didn't necessarily welcome him with open arms. The club all but fell apart. Reyes, whose legs would have been better served bubble-wrapped, missed the final month, and when he went out, so did the verve and panache he brought. The Mets of September 2003 with a team of shortstop Jorge Velandia, the latest in a line of Mets middle infielders who wasn't going to make anybody forget Ray Ordonez or Jose Reyes. The Mets of September 2003 with a team of second baseman Danny Garcia, who never surpassed his initial claim to fame. Danny was the first Brooklyn Cyclone to make the majors. The Mets of September 2003 with a team of center fielder Jeff Duncan, who had a terrific glove and, for no apparent reason, a bat. Jeff batted 194 in his audition. The Mets of September 2003 with a team of Prentice Redman, the outfielder who, on September 4th, in his second major league start, whacked a game-tying ninth-inning home run off Phillies closer Jose Mesa at the soon-to-be-imploded Veterans Stadium, only to have David Weathers enter a mess made by Mike Stanton in the bottom of the inning and lose the game. Redman had never homered before in a big league game and never would again. The Mets of September 2003 would have few moments down the stretch to feel even a little bit good about, because the Mets would lose 19 of their final 23 games to finish 66-95. The technical term for that would be yeesh. Nelson Doubleday, who had sold his half of the franchise to his erstwhile partner a year earlier, put it even better in July when he told reporter Larry Rocca of the Newark Star-Ledger, "I think it's been awful out there. I don't want to fire shells at somebody, but we're 22 games out. We might fall into a minor league. We might not even make it into Triple A." As for the Roberto Alomar trade that had recently taken place, Doubleday analyzed, "I read in another paper that it was a very good trade, but it would have been an excellent trade if they had included Jeff Wilpon," of whom Doubleday added, "Mr. Jeff Wilpon has decided that he's going to learn how to run a baseball team and take over at the end of the year. Run for the hills, boys." Yet there is one more story from the closing weeks and days of 2003 that needs telling. And while it doesn't exactly fit under the heading of feel good, it was there to remind us that there was always, through the good and bad of 42 Mets seasons, underlying strain of happiness. On July 27th, a sense of Met history permeated the air, both at Shea Stadium and way upstate. In Cooperstown, the Baseball Hall of Fame was inducting two of its newest members, each of them a Met for part of his career. One was Eddie Murray, who nobody expected to be shown on his plaque in a Mets cap because Eddie was first and foremost a Baltimore Oriole icon. The other, though, had a decent case for reaching immortality in bronze, orange, and blue. On his sixth ballot, one of the greatest catchers in modern baseball lore, Gary Carter, was elected by the writers. It was Gary Carter who was the greatest all-around catcher the Mets ever had before Mike Piazza. It was Gary Carter who was on the receiving end of that strike three that Marty Barrett swung through and sent Jesse Rosso's glove into the stratosphere, Jesse to his knees, and Mets fans everywhere into a frenzy. It was Gary Carter who stood at the podium in Cooperstown this beautiful summer Sunday in 2003 and said, "The greatest thrill of my career certainly was that amazing 86 World Series. Nothing will ever top that, and the memories will last forever. All of you that were there, everybody will remember that dramatic Game 6 and certainly the way we came back in that series. So all you Mets fans, God bless you, 86. But it wasn't Gary Carter in a Mets cap on that plaque. The Hall of Fame deferred to his longer, more accomplished Expos tenure in portraying Kid for immortality. Never mind that the loopy Montreal M on that plaque would be out of circulation in a major league sense in a little over 14 months, as MLB shifted the owner-orphaned Expos to Washington. No Met besides Tom Seaver, by 2003 a Mets announcer for over-the-air games on Channel 11, had been inducted into the Hall as a Met, and none would be until Piazza 13 summers later. Still, if you were at Shea that day, you were thinking about Carter, and you were thinking about all that had happened as the Mets hadn't had a year quite as blessed since 86, including 96, the year the Mets were supposed to be led by young pitching the way they had been so often. That was the era slated to be defined by Jason Isringhouse, Bill Pulsifer, and most of all, if things worked out, by Paul Wilson. Wilson was the number one draft pick in the country in 1994, a selection the Mets earned by being the most dreadful team in the land in 1993. Righty Wilson, a hard thrower, projected to follow in the footsteps of Seaver and Doc Gooden, endured a tough rookie campaign in 1996, was beset by injuries thereafter, and was traded away in 2000. So no, things didn't work out. Yet on July 27, 2003, you could not think of Paul Wilson if you were watching the Mets play the Reds, because pitching for the Reds, having worked his tail off to get the chance to make something of his potential, was Paul Wilson. The Mets' top draft choice of 1994 was facing off against Heilman, the Mets' top draft choice of 2001. Against the backdrop of Murray and Carter going to the Hall of Fame, what else did you need? If you were at Shea, hopefully you had your historical totem to add to the sense that there was a certain Met magic in the air. On this day, if you were among the first 35,000 adults through the turnstiles, you received a two-man bobblehead. There was a likeness of Ralph Kiner brandishing a cigar, and there was his blood brother, Bob Murphy, clutching a microphone. Ralph and Bob had been with the Mets every step of the way. A year earlier, when the franchise turned 40, they had their respective broadcasting booths named in their honor. The TV guys, whose ranks still included the old Pirate Slugger, talked in the Ralph Kiner television booth. The radio crew, which still featured the Oklahoman who got his start in the 1950s working alongside Kirk Gowdy in Boston, conducted its business from the Bob Murphy radio booth. Neither Kiner nor Murphy was on the air as much as they had been when it was just them and Lindsey Nelson, accounting and describing every single inning on radio and television till 1978, but they were still part of the Mets scene. At the very least, they deserved a bobblehead. It was unimaginable that the actual men who modeled for that souvenir wouldn't always be part of the Mets scene. Yet as Sunday, July 27th progressed, with Wilson's Reds outscoring Heilman's Mets, came a bulletin from the scoreboard that clarified for every Mets fan that always wasn't necessarily permanent. Bob Murphy, on the bobbled head day he shared with Ralph Kiner, let it be known at the end of 2003, he would be retiring from baseball. Mets fans everywhere were stunned. Murphy may have been nearing 80, may not have been as strong vocally as he'd once been, and may have deserved a chance to go out on his own terms, but it still bordered on unimaginable. Bob Murphy wasn't just the radio voice of the Mets or even the voice of the Mets. For those of us who'd experienced most, if not all, of the life of the New York Mets, Bob Murphy was as much as anybody the Mets. Always, however, would have to be processed conceptually more than literally once we passed Thursday night, September 25th, a hastily declared Bob Murphy night, arranged for the final home game of the season by the last place Mets. As July became August and August became September, it slowly sank in that Murph was about to cap his career. Every game he did, every word he spoke, and the limited schedule he kept in his final years on the job seemed more valuable than ever. No broadcast hit closer to the heart than the Friday night affair against the Expos on September 19th. MSG showed the good taste to pair Bob and Ralph one more time. They'd been separated by medium since 1982, once Frank Cashin decided Murph should be exclusive to radio and Kiner's Corner should be limited to TV. For a few innings, it wasn't 2003 anymore. It could have been any year from when the Mets were enchanting us in the days of Stengel or Hodges or Berra. Bob Murphy night arrived. The house wasn't packed, which was a shame. Some who'd bought tickets were held up in Triborough Bridge construction. It was a very 2003 evening to give the man who was the Mets his night. But Murph was going to be Murph no matter what. After being presented with plaudits and presents, Bob made his farewell speech, and he made it about other people. When Murph spoke, he paid homage to everybody but himself. Mets fans, us of all people, were unbelievably good, loyal, friendly. In those first years, 62, 63, 64, baseball was such fun. He liked the days when the announcers got to know the fans a lot better. The Mets would win one game a week and everybody would be happy. Casey would keep him and Ralph and Lindsay up to the wee hours and then tell them he'd meet them for breakfast. Casey was wonderful, as were Tom Seaver and Gil Hodges and Yogi Berra, pure as the driven snow per Murph. And 1969 and 1973, and those years, dynasty teams, the Orioles and Reds, the Mets beat to win what they had won. Ownership, starting with Mrs. Payson right up to Fred Wilpon, was great too, having always stood up for the fans. And I love the fans. They're terrific. He was going to have to answer a lot of mail this winter because he'd gotten lots of it wishing him well since he'd announced he'd be retiring. Murph wasn't about Murph. Murph didn't talk about his announcing, only whom he'd been around and what he'd reported. And the Mets fans, entities who provided me with a way of life that I've loved so much, you just can't possibly believe how much I love it. At the end, just after praising his partner of 15 seasons, Gary Cohn, as the best baseball broadcaster in the country, he can really get it done. Bob Murphy got as personal as he was ever likely to. I hate to say goodbye so much. I know I have no choice. It was a lot easier saying hello the first day we came to New York 42 years ago than it is saying goodbye here tonight. There's no point in keeping you waiting any longer. Let me tell you how much I love you. Let me tell you how great you have been. I'm going to miss you. Believe me, I will. I'll start missing you the minute I walk off this field. It has been such a marvelous, marvelous time. On behalf of my wife, Joy, we both say thanks to you for being so good to us, for allowing us to be a part of your life, and for enjoying baseball with us. Thank you very much. Good night and God bless. With that, Bob hugged Joy and we resumed our applause, which had been intermittent but hearty for half an hour. The PA played Yesterday Once More by the Carpenters, its first lyrics more than appropriate to the occasion. When I was young, I'd listen to the radio. And we all got a little older as the Mets went on to lose the final game of Bob Murphy's broadcasting career, the last time, save for a spring training cameo, that we hear from him. Murph died in August of 2004. St. Patrick's Cathedral was brimming with Mets fans. The rainy afternoon, his life was celebrated in that sacred spot. It wasn't until 2023 that the Mets deigned to hang a disc in Bob's honor at their ballpark by then Citi Field. But they finally effectively retired his number, his microphone. This year, right next to Ralph Kiner's in the left field rafters, they are together always, right where we've never stopped hearing them. Murph would be uncomfortable with this much attention. So for the record, on September 25th, starter Tom Glavine, finishing a 4.52 ERA first season as a Met, could at least say he knew his first baseman well. It was his brother, Mike Glavine, who was about as nepo sibling a September call-up as one could fathom. How Jeff Wilpon resisted the urge to activate himself is a mystery. Mike Glavine didn't finish the game, however. Come the ninth inning, Art Howe, taking his last shot at lighting up Shea in 2003, shifted his starting catcher to first base. Yes, he hadn't forgotten that he planned to make a first baseman of Mike Piazza. Let the record show that the last three Met defensive outs recorded with 1994 Ford Frick Award winner Bob Murphy behind the radio mic were all put outs by Piazza. Still, when Mike entered the Hall in 2016, his plaque referred to him as a durable and prolific power-hitting catcher and offered no clue first base was ever somewhere Piazza stood unless it was after singling. If Mike Piazza being assigned first base seemed like a bad or at least weird dream, the 2003 Mets left Shea after Bob Murphy night with a chance to wake up from their nightmare of the franchise's worst season since 1993. They had one last set of games left with the Marlins in Miami. When the Mets were last there, they were flirting with perfection and edging ahead of Florida in standings. Shortly after they left, the Marlins called up minor leaguer Miguel Cabrera and in no time passed the Mets, charged into the wild card race, and positioned themselves to clinch a playoff spot with the New Yorkers in attendance. Unsurprisingly, the Marlins beat the Mets and over their next three series defeated the Giants in four in the NLDS, the Cubs in seven in the NLCS, and the Yankees in six in the Fall Classic. The Mets lost 12 of 19 to the eventual world champions, but at least we could tell the Yankees fans we could beat Florida more than twice. That may not be the flex one wishes it to be, considering we lost all six Subway Series games that year, the first time we ever managed that double hat trick. Really, what we had to celebrate when 2003 was over was that, in the best tradition of Yogi Berra's managerial genius 30 years before, it was over. When we woke up for 2004, Jose Reyes would be there, if not until June, thanks to injuries. And David Wright would be there, if not until July, thanks to seasoning. And despite Nelson Doubleday's warnings from the sidelines, Jeff Wilpon would be there too. Running for the hills might have seemed advisable. But even when run by Jeff and Father Fred, the Mets, as fueled by those youngsters, would start running up that hill and achieving something in a fairly short period of time. Having little idea of what will happen after what happens in three seems to happen a lot. When we next leap ahead 10 years and land in 2013, we'll see if that's a truism for all time. Until then, on behalf of my podcast partner, Jeff, we both say thanks to you for being so good to us, for allowing us to be a part of your life, and for enjoying baseball with us. Thank you very much. Good night and God bless.
Another great segment, Greg, and we look forward to 2013 in September. And you mentioned Tsuyoshi Shinjo, also known as Big Boss, according to Wikipedia. He is now the current manager of the Fighters. The name of the company that owns them is Nippon Ham. So they are not Fighting Ham. They are the Nippon Ham Fighters.
Unless they are a team of kosher ball players, and in which case they may be fighting the urge to have a little ham now and then. I'm sure they're good boys no matter what faith they follow. You know what? One of the things I enjoy as we get a little closer to the present is coming across names that are still in baseball, like Tsuyoshi Shinjo, like Bruce Bochy. He was managing a terrible Padres team after having managed a really good Padres team in the 90s, and he would soon be managing a really good Giants team for a very long time. And now he's back again, managing a Texas Rangers team that, with Max Scherzer, is going to the playoffs most likely. It's been an experience for me feeling time march on and kind of catch up to where we are. Again, some of these names have, like names from 1963 and 83, have disappeared except when somebody bothers to look them up. But some of these guys are still on the scene in their way. You may have noticed I slipped in the name Miguel Cabrera toward the end. Miguel Cabrera, the only active player from 2003 still around in 2023, and he's calling it an amazing career this year. So when we get to 2013, even more than any of the other seasons we've talked about, it will feel like yesterday or yesterday once more.
We need your help, folks. At this time of the season, we thought we were going to be discussing the playoff push, playoff positioning, who the Mets were going to play in the playoffs. Obviously, none of that's going to happen. So we need your help. This is not the type of podcast where we're going to discuss Rafael Ortega's weighted on base average. There are other podcasts who might do that. We're not. So help us out. We want to do at least one, maybe two mailbag segments. So send us your thoughts. Send us your notes. Send us your Met memories. NationalLeagueTown@gmail.com.
Send us your Johnny Walker blue, because this has been a tough season.
Could use some of that. And we'll be back next week with more. So until then, I'm Jeff Heisen.
I'm Greg Prince.
And as always, let's go Mets. Copyright 2023, music provided by the Royal Arctic Institute. Their latest album, From Coma to Catharsis, is now available on vinyl. For more information and tour dates, check them out on Bandcamp.